Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement to defend children's rights in matters of marriage and family and beyond. We are so glad that you're with us today. We're going to talk with Josh Wood in this first segment about our upcoming book, Pro-Child Politics, and then we're going to have an interview with one of the authors. But before we get into that, as always, we're going to do a little bit of Bible time. And I was wrapping up Matthew, and it's been a fantastic journey in Matthew. I feel like I spend a lot of time in the Old Testament. I'm kind of like crazy about the prophets. And so I was like, time to go with a little bit of New Testament. So I took a deep dive into Matthew, and I wrapped up today. And obviously, we've been in church land for a long, long time. My husband was the senior pastor of our church for 14 years and just recently transitioned to be a full-time chaplain in the Navy. So I'm very, very familiar with the Great Commission. But there was something about it today that really hit me differently. And it's probably because I'm a mom, and I've got one kid in college. Next week, we are taking our second kid to college, and I'm at the place where I don't want to say I'm at the end of the mothering journey. I'm still like solidly in the middle, maybe about to head into the fourth quarter, but like we're not at the beginning anymore. And I look at this Great Commission and what Christ said for us to do, and it was to go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all that I have commanded of you. And obviously, very familiar words to most of you, but just the reflection that disciples don't pop out of nowhere. You do not just get born into the family of God and bam, disciple, fully formed. No, that actually this process of teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded, it doesn't happen in an instant. It happens over years and years. So I'm going to just lay out sort of a little cheat that we explain in our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City. And it's this model of training your kids that's actually based on Christ's interaction with his disciples. So it goes like this. I do, you watch. Then I do, you help. Then you do, I help. And then you do, I watch. So this is a very simple formula that you can use to teach your kids anything, to teach them how to make scrambled eggs, to teach them how to do their laundry, to teach them to follow Christ, to teach them to stand firmly on their worldview and do not bend regardless of who comes for you or who threatens you over it. And so this is the model that Christ used with his disciples as he was teaching them to be about the kingdom of God and to make disciples. We see that he first let them watch, right? The I do, you watch. He let the disciples watch him calm the storm and heal the lame and open the eyes of the blind, heal the sick, cast out demons. Like first they got to just drink it in and watch him. And then the I do, you help. Then he allowed the disciples to start helping him in that work, helping him pass out the bread, right? When he was feeding 5,000. And then he said, you're going to do this, but I'm going to help you. So he sends them out on a few short-term missions to start to do the things that he had done. And it's here at the Great Commission where he says, now go. Now you're the teacher. Now you're going to do, and I'm going to watch. I mean, he's with us always to the end of the age, but he's not physically next to them any longer. So this is such a good exhortation for all of us who are sending our kids out, whether it is off to kindergarten for the first time or out to college. This process, this slow handoff of worldview training is something that Christ did. It's something we've done with our kids. It's something that you can employ in the ways that you are teaching your kids, whether it is in terms of like how to make their own lunch or how to follow in Christ's footsteps. So I'll stop there and I'll say Josh Wood is at the other end of the parenting spectrum from me. He's got three little kids at home. Any thoughts on teaching kids to obey all that Christ has commanded, or just teaching kids in general?
You're talking about fourth quarter. I'm like, I'm in the middle of the second quarter, maybe, and often feel like I'm getting my butt kicked. So different perspective. The one part I want to just hone in on that I agree with, and I think in a world that is saturated with social media, we obviously all love our children, and here at Them Before Us, we ask people to put kids first and to be child-centric and to do hard things on their behalf. That can tip into, you know, making idols of our children. That's the extreme and the bad thing, where we do anything we can to protect them from anything. We derive value out of how well they're doing, and we want our identity to is somewhat wrapped up in how good we're doing at teaching and preaching and caring for them and discipling them. And, you know, I would say the one part of that kind of model was they do, we help, and eventually we're watching, right? That sometimes involves failure. Like, I would just say, I ran a soccer club in Charlotte, North Carolina for a while, and watching people deal with their kids getting cut from teams was a really good lesson in leadership and you know, not putting my identity into how my kid's doing. Because at some point, we do need to realize we've done all we can. We're releasing them to the world. We're hoping we've trained them and prepared them, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to go through hard times. They're not going to fail. They're not going to, you know, try and mess up. And A, that's not like, you can't take all the credit when they do awesome, and you can't take all the blame when they make poor decisions either. You're working with God. You're doing your best to do hard things on their behalf. You're not wrapping up your identity into who they are. You're praying for them every day. And when they make mistakes, as you've shared in some of your books, you're trying to stay connected during that phase so they can come back to you when their life falls apart. And again, that's all a part of the discipleship process. The disciples, as you pointed out, they had plenty of those boneheaded decisions, failures. But one last thing would be when Peter denies Christ, I know that's such an example of this failure, right? But I love to point out too that it was because he stayed by Jesus and close enough to Jesus that Jesus could look back at him, that it makes the moment so much more poignant. Everyone else had deserted. Now, he definitely denies Christ, but part of the reason he could even deny Christ and Christ could look from him, you know, look back at him and all that, is because he was still there. So he was even doing a good job of being a disciple, trying his hardest, but that put him in a position where his failure became very public. And again, his parents, we got to be there to wrap our arms back around and say, it's okay. It's all right. I'm here with you. I'm staying connected. And we're going to move on from this.
I love it. This is not a sprint. It is a multi-year process, a slow handoff of what does it mean to be a disciple of Christ, or what does it mean to just exist as a great sportsman on the field, right? In all these different areas, we are there to train our children. It does not happen in an instant. It needs to happen very deliberately during a slow handoff of you, the parent, transferring your knowledge and experience into your children's lives. Doing that while they're in your home is the best way to be able to make sure that you're connected to them through it all. So we are going to talk a little bit about our third book project, which is going to be out on September 24th, available now for pre-order, and it is called Pro-Child Politics. Now, what we do at Them Before Us is we put them, the children, before us, the adults. We primarily do this on matters of marriage and family, but when we speak and write, when we present at legislative conferences, we often talk about how you actually can put them before us, children before adults, on every major social issue, that actually you can look through the lens of child protection on anything from drag queen story hour to sex segregated sports and locker rooms to questions about reproductive technologies or abortion to matters of marriage and family to questions about pornography. You can actually come to the right conclusion policy-wise by prioritizing kids. And I've wondered for a long time if you could just do this on all of politics. And what would happen if you took every major political issue and you said, actually, we're going to prioritize kids and we're going to put them before adults. So I think that I was noodling around that, Josh, like earlier this year, and you had an idea.
Yeah. So, you know, that is the key, right? Is this idea that we could apply this worldview in its best form. It's adults seeking what is truly best for children, for what's required for them to flourish, what they need. And that we know that journey takes difficult choices by adults to take things they want and desire to hit the back seat so that kids can have what they need to grow up in a just society. And we had talked about that. I mean, what does that look like in our lane, marriage and family? But we had seen this application in so many places. And so, man, I think it was back in February that I shot you a text and said, pro-child party. What does it take for one party to become the party that represents kids? That, and I think your response was, you know, we're way too busy, or that's a lot of work. And thankfully, you kind of thought, well, but what if we divide this up into all the chapters with expert contributors? What would happen then? And I think then it was kind of off to the races.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because I think you're like, you know, we should write a book about this. And hey, writing books. Okay. All right. I mean, you write a book, your life is gone. You cannot do anything else when you're writing a book. It is all consuming. And I was like, oh, there's no way. But then I thought, I don't know. I don't want to say I don't want to know anything, but I can't write about immigration. I'm not the person to write about national security. I'm not an expert on debt or energy or the environment or ESG or DEI or education or race. I mean, like all these different, I thought how it would take me, right. I couldn't even become an expert on these things. And then I think something happened and we went, what if we just got
we've
the
got friends
and told them we've got friends. Yeah. And so it was pretty incredible because we wanted all these topics, but we wanted it in our way. We wanted all these experts to bring their area of expertise, but do it through our lens of putting children before adults. So then we just started reaching out to, you know, the brainiest of brains on all these topics and said, you want to write a 3,000 word chapter, like boiling down your very complex issue into one short, concise, bite-sized chapter and doing it from the perspective of child protection. Are you down with that? And we got 19 of them to say yes.
Yeah, that was, man, I've enjoyed the journey, the picking of the different people, seeing them kind of translate in their expert area. Hey, this is what it means to put kids first in this particular sector. What struck me is that it's not always obvious. Some things that seem compassionate, that seem culturally, you know, like they seem popular, they seem, you know, even sometimes, man, that seems like what we should be empathetic. Those weren't always the things that actually left kids better off in a generation. And so I thought that was one of my favorite parts of reading the book, was to see in all these different areas, specifically immigration was one of them, where, hey, I know we have this desire where if we could, we would be a place that could take in every person from a war-torn country, every person who was facing persecution. But at the same time, there are real limits on what we can do. And in fact, some of our best intentions may even incentivize more harm to kids. And we got to really take a step back and go, you know, maybe orderly, you know, an orderly process with very strict policies and laws. If we can get that right, maybe in the long run, we're going to be way better off to those people. Maybe not today that are looking for help, but maybe in 10 years. And I think it's that kind of delayed gratification sometimes that is so hard for us to wrap our minds around because it doesn't feel, you know, it's not what we naturally want to do.
Well, I had a lot to learn about a lot of the different topics that we covered in pro-child politics. And one of those was in the area of foreign policy. Like, I'm kind of like stuck between two worlds. Like, I've got voices on one side that's saying, look, we've got American ideals. It's the best thing for the world. We need to take our ideas and export them to all the different nations. We need to go out. We need to be the world's policemen. But then there's been this emergence of really like neo-isolationist voices on the right too, saying, no, we don't need to be involved in any of that business. We just need to worry about things at home, spend our money here, protect our own borders, and that's it. And so I was really grateful when Dan Caldwell said that he would write a chapter for our book on national security. And he spends 3,000 words and he identifies the lies, two of which I just explained about foreign policy. And then he puts his finger on the truth. And we're going to have him on the show next. We're going to get the up close and personal with Dan Caldwell on foreign policy.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We get a special guest today, not quite in studio, but in virtual studio. I've got Dan Caldwell with me, and he is the author of the chapter in Pro-Child Politics that we wrote on foreign policy. Dan, tell us briefly about yourself and why you were qualified to write this chapter.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on today. And it was a real honor to collaborate with you in this book. So a little background on myself. After high school, I joined the United States Marine Corps. I enlisted in the infantry. My first 2 years in the Marine Corps, I served as part of the Presidential Guard Unit up at Camp David. And then after that, I deployed to Iraq with 2nd Battalion 1st Marines. Once I got out of the Marine Corps, I went back to school, finished up on the GI Bill, and I worked for a member of Congress for 2 years, primarily working on veterans and defense issues. And then from there, I joined an organization called Concerned Veterans for America, which worked on VA issues, spending issues, and also eventually foreign policy. And then from there, I ultimately went to another organization called Stand Together, and I became eventually their vice president of foreign policy. So I've been working in the foreign policy space, if you include my time in the Marine Corps, a little over 15 years now. And so I've worked in foreign policy both as a practitioner in the Marines. I've worked on foreign policy in the legislative branch, and then now on the outside as both an advocate and somebody who helps craft different policies to implement a better American foreign policy.
Fantastic. So what you're saying is we found the right guy. Is that what you're saying?
I would say that I have been very blessed, including at my current organization, Defense Priorities, which is a foreign policy organization in Washington, D.C., to work with a lot of really smart people. And I would say that I've gotten really good at absorbing their ideas and then regurgitating them back to people. So if I'm the right guy, it's because I've had the honor of working around a lot of really smart people who know a lot about American foreign policy over the years. I've been able to learn a lot from them.
Good. Well, you shared it in a very tight space in Pro-Child Politics. I think I gave like the almost impossible task of saying to all of the different contributors, I want everything that we need to know about your topic in 3,000 words, which is really hard to do. And what I said to all of you guys is I want you to identify the lies of your area of expertise. Talk about how those lies harm kids. But then tell us the truth about your topic and what would happen? What would policy look like if we prioritize kids? So I want to go through some of the lies that you lay out that I think a lot of people have heard on the topic of foreign policy. So the first lie that you made very, very explicit is the lie that the United States needs to be the world's policeman. So who's saying this kind of thing and what's the impact?
Well, essentially, the idea that the United States need to be the world's policeman, that we need to be responsible for essentially everything that happens in every corner of the world, has been something that the foreign policy elites of both parties have believed since the end of the Cold War. And this has been something that you've seen advance under Republican administrations, like under George W. Bush, and under Democrat administrations like Bill Clinton and the current administration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. You really did see a break in this thinking in the Trump administration to a large extent. But still, most of the people that are responsible for our foreign policy believe that it is America's role to essentially ensure that the United States polices the world, not simply to keep the world safe, but to impose what many foreign policy scholars call liberal hegemony, meaning that liberal values, and mainly liberal values in the progressive sense, not necessarily the classical sense, are dominant around the world, believing that it's not only good for the world to be liberal, but the United States to be liberal. So that's led us to do things like invade Iraq, to try and turn Afghanistan into a perfect little liberal democracy. And that has cost us dearly in terms of blood and treasure. But it also has distracted us from things that we need to do to make ourselves secure and ultimately prosperous, and to focus on real threats to our safety and our security, whether it's things like China or actual terrorist threats, not, you know, threats that really don't actually pose a threat to our existence as a country. And so it's been that pursuit of liberal hegemony, which some call primacy on the right, some people call it neoconservatism, that has really distracted us from a foreign policy that actually prioritizes America's interest in doing what we need to do to keep ourselves safe.
Well, let's pause there, because you're going to get to the prescription of actually what our foreign policy should look like. But there's two more lies that you outlined first. The second lie was that we don't need a strong military. So who is saying that, and what evidence do we have that some people actually think that?
Well, I'm somebody who does believe in that we need to pursue a more realist and what I'd say restrained foreign policy. I know we're going to talk about it in a minute. That does not preclude us from having a strong military. I believe that we should still, even if we're doing less around the world militarily, we still need to have a military second to none. And primarily, we need to have a military with a strong Navy and Air Force, because that enables us to project power globally in a more rapid manner. Unfortunately, we have built a military that is geared to fight wars of the past, like whether it's counterinsurgency conflicts or Desert Storm, and not geared towards the actual threats we face. And so that has made us less safe. And there's a lot of reasons we could record multiple episodes on this. It has a lot to do with politics, has to do with special interests. And we don't have the military that we need for the world that we currently have. Now, there are some folks who support a more restrained or non-interventionist foreign policy that believe that we should essentially implement massive cuts to the United States military. Look, I think there's a lot of waste in the military. I think there's some unnecessary spending. But I even though I support a more restrained foreign policy, I'm not somebody who believes we should massively cut the size of our military or gut it. I believe that the primary responsibility of government is to keep us safe. And so therefore, we should have a strong and effective military.
Good. So you map out what the military strategy should look like if we are going to have a foreign policy that not just protects us, but actually prioritizes children and what they need. But before we get to that, you knock out one more lie, and that is that if we are going to have the kind of realism and restraint that you go on to detail, that means that we're isolationists. So why aren't we isolationists, or why isn't what you're proposing isolationism?
So anytime you hear anyone call someone an isolationist, whether it's Donald Trump or Senator J.D. Vance or Senator Josh Hawley or Senator Rand Paul or Mike Lee, they're using that term as a smear. They're using that as a term to try and discredit people without having an honest conversation about what those people actually believe. And in a lot of cases, they're using that term to distract away from the fact that those individuals who primarily use that term, like people like Max Boot and Bill Kristol and even President Biden, that they have actually been responsible for advocating for implementing some of the biggest foreign policy failures of not just the last 20 years, but the last 30 years. And so a foreign policy rooted in realism and restraint recognizes that there are actual threats to the United States, that we need to prepare for those threats by having a strong military. But it means having a high bar for using the military and not using the military to do things like try and create a liberal democracy in Afghanistan, or to build girls' schools in the deserts of Anbar province, Iraq, where I spent some time. It is focusing military power, and it's also, too, using other tools of American statecraft outside the military, whether it's diplomatic engagement, whether it's trade and cultural exchanges. That's not isolationism. They're really in American politics. There is nobody who can be described accurately right now as an isolationist. There are sure people on the right-wing fringe or left-wing fringe that maybe you could call that, but none of them are anywhere near the center of the debate. And so it's really just a red herring to distract away from what we actually believe and what the debate is really focused on.
Good. So you're saying that, like, really the main error that we've fallen into when it comes to foreign policy is thinking that we are the world's policeman, that really the tool that we need to use for our military is really to recreate the American experiment in all of these places that really are not necessarily poised to become little American surrogate states, right? And that as a result, we have weakened our nation. And let me just read this quote that you said in your chapter. It is American children more than any other group in the U.S. who will have to bear the burden of America's failed foreign policy. What do you really feel like the cost to children is because we have gotten foreign policy wrong? What are the main areas where kids are harmed?
So I think that the group of children, and I talk about this in the chapter, who paid the biggest price has been the children of military families. They have had to endure long periods of time away from their parents due to many unnecessary deployments. Military families, unfortunately, suffer the highest divorce rates of any career field in the country. And look, military life, even if we had a better foreign policy, will inevitably be tough. But we've made it unnecessarily tough by overusing our military around the world. And so that's why one reason why the military has such a high divorce rate. And we all know the impact of divorce on children. And then, unfortunately, we've had hundreds of thousands of children who have either lost a parent in some of these unnecessary wars or have had their parents severely wounded or disabled by these wars, and those children's lives are irreparably changed as a result of that. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the children of military families; it's all American children.
Yeah.
These wars have cost us dearly in terms of our national debt. I know there's a chapter on the national debt that lays out the impact of that debt and how it threatens their financial future. But $10 trillion of our national debt, in one way or another, was caused by the post 9/11 wars. So they're going to have to build the burden of that. In addition, they're going to have to deal with a world where the United States is less prepared to deal with real threats, mainly the threat emanating from China and East Asia. And so since we aren't prepared for that, and I'm not somebody who believes that we should preordain a conflict with China, but it is something that we need to be prepared for. God forbid, you know, we sleepwalk into a situation where we're in war with China, that could be disastrous for the United States. And our children and their futures would be impacted by that. And I think to close on this is that our foreign policy is one of the many factors that is risking the future safety and economic prosperity of our children, and why, unfortunately, we sit here in the United States where it is likely that our children and future generations will not have the same opportunity, the same level of prosperity that the past few generations have had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. You make it very, very clear in your chapter that you've got the very direct victims of the kids who have lost their parents in conflicts that did not necessarily make us more secure or prosperous. In fact, may have stirred things up or lost us credibility in ways that make it harder for us to fight in the future. And then you say, let me tell you the truth about American foreign policy. And you talk over and over about how the real path forward is realism and restraint. So give us 1 minute on what is realism and restraint.
So realism and restraint is two essential foreign policy doctrines that go together very well. They pair well together. So realism is a foreign policy ideology. It's one of the oldest foreign policy ideologies that recognize that the nations have interests and that they act in those interests, and that the world is the way it is, and that a country like the United States, outside of the United States, has limited ability to change it. And we should recognize that. And like other nations, we should prioritize our interests in that world, and that we should lead with that in our foreign policy. It also recognizes that balances of power between nations shift, and the world is changing. Again, we have limited ability at times to affect that, but we should accept the way the world is, not as we want it. Again, outside the United States, that shouldn't apply to the United States. Restraint argues that the United States has limited power. Even though we are the most powerful country in the world, there's limits on our powers. We need to use it judiciously, especially our military power. And our military power should only be used as a last resort. And so that's not saying we never use military power. Like when after 9/11, we had every reason to go into Afghanistan to punish the Taliban and destroy Al-Qaeda and kill bin Laden. But what we didn't need to do is execute a 20-year nation-building exercise. So that sums up realism and restraint. And I would just close by saying is that if you go back in history, that's essentially the foreign policy our founding fathers wanted us to pursue. And so it's really a return to what our founding fathers articulated at the birth of our nation. And the fact that we didn't pursue a more interventionist foreign policy and then get involved in all the wars in Europe in the late 18th century and 19th century is one reason we became so strong as a nation by the end of the 19th century. So again, it's looking back to the wisdom of our founding fathers and returning to what they saw as the best foreign policy for this country.
Good. So we've had some times in our nation where we have gravitated more towards the isolationist perspective. And more recently, we've been in this sort of world's policeman nation building strategy. And you're saying both of those fall kind of outside of what the founding fathers intended, which was this more targeted, more realistic use of our foreign forces. And I'll just wrap up with this quote. You say, a more restrained and realist American foreign policy will benefit America's children by better protecting them from actual threats to their well-being, because there really are threats that are coming for our nation and specifically our kids. So, Dan, thank you again for authoring this chapter and contributing to this project that I hope is going to shape not just an election, but an electorate.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today and allowing me to participate in this. It was really enjoyable writing this, and I encourage everybody to get the book and read the whole thing. I'm looking forward to reading it myself.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
I am so glad you were able to join us. We are going to head to your questions now, because we can spend a lot of time talking about who children are, what they need, to whom they have a right, what we need to provide them when it comes to provision and protection. And we can outline all these ideals, all of these non-negotiables when it comes to child protection. And then there's the tricky challenge of how to live it out, because it's one thing to understand all of these principles, and it's another thing to say, okay, but how do I do that in my own struggling marriage, or when I've got a sister who's just decided to come out of the closet, or when my child is the one that's dealing with this at school? How do I talk about this with them? How do I equip them? And so we always want to devote some time to your questions, because we don't just want to dive into all of these truths. We want to understand how to live them out effectively. Sometimes that's messy. And so we are always looking to answer your questions. For this segment, we've got my training director, Jen Friesen, on with us. And she also runs our social media. So she puts out questions on our Twitter, on our Instagram, on our Facebook, soliciting your feedback and your questions. And she gathers them through the week. And then she brings them to us on the weekend. So Jen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Fun to be here.
Good. Well, let us know, like, what are people saying? What kind of questions do we have this week?
Yeah, we got some good ones for you this week, Katie. This one, we'll start with this. This is from Lacey, one of our social media followers. She asks, I'm just about to graduate college and I've got a wonderful boyfriend. Should we wait until we've paid off our loans and can buy a house before we get married?
Aha. First of all, congratulations, Lacey. Nice that you found a great guy. As you probably are aware, the dating scene is insane these days because people don't date. I mean, there tends to be two different ways to form relationships with the opposite sex, two popular pathways. One is constant friend zoning where you're just texting and you don't ever actually establish some kind of relationship. And the other one is you skip the relationship altogether and you hook up. And so you've got these two terrible polarizations, neither of which are good for you or for your future man. So I'm glad that you're dating and glad that you found a great guy. And the question of should you get married, even if you're not what you would think maybe in a situation that lends itself to financial stability or even prosperity, the answer is yes. Girl, have him put a ring on it. Why? Because I think that there are some messages that the next generation is getting these days that says, pay off your loans, buy a house, establish a career, make sure that you've like traveled all that you want to do before you get married. And I would call that, not me, but I've heard it said, that is more of a capstone model of marriage, right? First, you're building the pyramid of your life, and then ding, you put a little capstone on the top, that's marriage. That's not the best way to go about it. Think about marriage more as a cornerstone, right? Set that stone in place. If you've found the right person, if your values align, do it first. And then build your life together. Build it out financially. Build it out in terms of your career. Build it up when it comes to having children. That's the way to go. And yeah, that means that you might be living very modestly for a while. But when we actually look at the numbers, getting married earlier in your early 20s and starting to build your life together, especially if you have not hooked up, especially if you guys have not lived together first, that's actually your best odds at a thriving future relationship.
A friend of Them Before Us, Brad Wilcox, wrote a book called Get Married. So that's a book people can check out whether you're wanting to get married or already married. There's some great advice and thoughts there. Good thoughts there from you as well, Katie. All right, another one. This one's from Jacob. He says, my parents divorced when I was 16. I'm now 28 with two kids, and I still feel like I have to mediate between my mom and dad, which is a lot more challenging now that my mom is remarried to a guy who isn't very interested in having a relationship with me. How do I still honor my mom and dad?
You are in the challenging position that a lot of children of divorce find themselves in, which is actually having to function as the adult in the relationship. The way that it's supposed to work is parents, when the kids are young, or even sometimes when everybody is an adult, parents are supposed to be supportive, understanding, accommodating of the kids. And what often happens after divorce is it's the kids who have to be supportive, understanding, and accommodating of the adults, of their parents, whether that means, you know, shuttling messages between the two because they are not able to live at peace with one another, whether that means accommodating new spouses or live-ins that are coming in and out of their life, whether that means having to bear the emotional burden of just walking through the grief and loss alone because the parents have romantically moved on. That's a really hard place to be. And Jen, I want you to jump in here too, because you've interviewed a lot of kids. You're familiar with a lot of stories of children of divorce. I've got some thoughts, more thoughts on kind of moving forward, but do you have any thoughts on that? Like how can a child who is now an adult navigate those challenging waters?
It is interesting because in my life, so when my mom remarried, you do feel this sense of loyalty to your biological mom and dad that you don't want to call the step parent mom and dad necessarily. And it's a little different when they remarry after you're an adult. And it's interesting too, that without your parent loving that person, you probably wouldn't have any sort of relationship with them, right? Your paths wouldn't cross naturally. And so there's difficult things to navigate there. I think for me, I think about treating them as someone, if they treat your mom or dad well, then I look at it that way. They can be a good friend. I can be a good friend to them. I'm going to honor the ways they reach out. I'm going to reciprocate. I'm going to make an effort for my parent that I care about to love the person and care for the person they care for. But it is really hard because you kind of feel disloyal. If you were to be close to your stepdad, it feels disloyal to your dad or vice versa. So those are difficult things to navigate for sure.
Yeah. As you move forward, I think a lot of help comes from simply recognizing that you're not going to have the same kind of relationship that maybe some of your peers do with their parents, where they really can go to them to rely on them for support, even for moral guidance. You might have to start transferring some of those kind of paternal and maternal care, especially as it relates to just somebody to look to as an example, onto other people. Maybe it's an aunt or uncle or a set of grandparents that have been faithfully married. Maybe it's somebody at your church that you're like, they're doing marriage right, and I want to follow them. Also, if you've got kids and you're now kind of having to deal with, in essence, being the adult in the relationship in both up and down, I would just say sometimes you need to prioritize your kids. I mean, sometimes, maybe not in your situation, there's a lot of drama with your divorced parents, either between the two of them or just in their new kind of family formations or romantic, you know, pursuits. And sometimes you just need to circle the wagons and say, right now is my time to be a parent and focus on my own children. And I am going to create the home for my kids that I wish I had had when I was a child.
Yeah, that's a good note. All right. Another question. This one's from Alexis. She says, my sister is struggling to get pregnant and has brought up IVF as an option. She and her husband would be such wonderful parents, and I really want to support her, but I'm also concerned about IVF. How do I walk this line?
We always need to be, man, in all the different, especially marriage and family spaces that Them Before Us wades into, whether it is, you know, matters of when to get married or dealing with an unplanned pregnancy or longing for a very planned pregnancy or dealing with somebody's gender confusion or sexual orientation or a marriage that's on the rocks and really struggling to stay together. In all of those situations, we aim to be an incredibly empathetic and supportive friend. Somebody to whom the sister, the friend, the niece, the nephew, the coworker can come to and mourn or grieve or express their longing or their hopes or whatever it is. And we want to be the place where that can be received. And in whatever way possible, we want to empathize and support them as they work on their marriage, as they wrestle through their feelings of gender confusion, as they confront the fear of an unplanned pregnancy, and certainly in a situation of infertility where these people want something that is so worthy and honestly so inborn and ingrained. It's good to want children. And in all of those situations, especially at Them Before Us, we say the primary thing that needs to guide your interaction is not necessarily sympathy for the adult. It is child protection. And we can and should bear the burden of our friends who are struggling, but draw a hard line in the sand of saying, regardless of your feelings, your fear, your longing, your loss, no amount of adult emotion justifies victimizing children, violating their rights, either their right to life or their right to be known and loved by both their mother and father.
We've talked about this before on the podcast or your other interviews and things, that a way to try to mitigate defensiveness too can be asking a lot of questions or sharing what you've learned from the radio program, from the book. You can say, you know, I read this study or I read this story of a kid who experienced this. Have you thought about this ethical question? And that can be a good way to go about it versus just saying, you're wrong, do not do that. And then someone's immediately defensive and now you're in a big argument.
Yeah, we're big fans of empathizing, but then saying, have you looked at it from the child's perspective? And ultimately it comes down to, it's an injustice to transfer your burdens onto the shoulder of a child.
Right. Okay, do we have time for final question here?
Let's do it.
All right. So this one's from Catherine. She says, we just got married 2 years ago. I love my husband, but I feel like I'm doing all the work. He plays a lot of video games, sometimes 2 to 5 hours in the evening. We both work, so that means I'm doing the housework while he plays. It makes me bitter and resentful. What should I do?
And what was this person's name?
Catherine.
Catherine. Okay, Catherine. I just want to say you're not special. Like, you're not special. Welcome to the world of marriage. I'm not saying that everybody has experienced this exact struggle, but you know, my husband and I have been in ministry for 25 years. We've done lots of marriage counseling. We've walked with a lot of people who have been in a lot of different stages of marriage. And I will just say that working out these areas of like, how do we collaborate, cooperate on matters of like marriage and parenting and housework and all of that is really challenging. And I will tell you this observation, that it does take a little bit longer for men and husbands to start to unplug from the life that they were living as bachelors and plug in to a life of doing the world together as partners. That does not always mean splitting the housework 50-50. It doesn't mean, you know, you're both working full-time or you're both working half-time. I'm saying like seeing the other person as a priority and deferring to their needs. Women just do this more naturally. I mean, we more naturally look to the needs of others, single or married, right? And that is why we tend to be killer stay-at-home parents, because we're just constantly aware of what's going on with our kids and what they need. Men these days are actually doing a lot of heavy lifting when it comes to housework and fatherings in ways that they didn't in the past. But it also takes men a little bit longer to look to the needs of others rather than to themselves. I've got some final thoughts, but I'll let you jump in here, Jen. You know, what are you seeing? What are your thoughts?
I agree. I think it just takes time for people to learn how to be together, don't you think? Because if you think about sort of the traditional American experience now, it seems like you grow up in your house, whether you have siblings or not. Sharing a room even is not really that much of an American ideal anymore. You know, kind of everybody gets their own room. You have your own space. Maybe you have a roommate again in college, but that's a different dynamic. And then people are being single, staying single longer and longer. So if you're single into your 30s, that's a big adjustment to then all of a sudden be sharing a lot of space. So I agree. Like patience, good communication. I think women sometimes assume he's going to read your mind and he knows I need help and he doesn't care. But maybe you just need to have a conversation.
Yeah, that's like the perfect setup for where I was going to like wrap this up is, be understanding. And yes, do some communicating. But I will also say this, like there are two errors that you can fall into here, because sometimes there are issues that he's going to need to bring to you and you're going to need to bring to him. So for the wives out there, this is my advice. If there is something in his world or that he's doing, the choices he's making that are damaging or that is impacting you or really needs to be brought up, here's what you need to do. You need to tell it to him once very clearly, because just like Jen said, the boy cannot read your mind. I mean, for all he knows, he's thinking you love this because you get some extra alone time, right? So you need to very clearly one time say, it really hurts me that you spend so much more time with your friends on video games than with me. I'd consider it an act of love if we could set apart two or three nights to spend time together or go out with friends in real life, because I want to strengthen this relationship with you. You say it one time and then you shut up. You don't bring it up over and over and over and over and over again. Okay. Because what I've noticed is there are two things that change men's behavior. There are two things that move the needle on especially bad decisions that men are making. One of those things is consequences. One of those things is running up against the problem with the choices that he's making and letting the consequences teach him, not you nagging him. The other thing that changes men's behavior is other good men. When you say it, okay, he can hear it. But when another guy says, dude, what are you doing? You just got married. You've been playing 4 hours of video games at night? Okay, that's actually not how to do a marriage. You gotta cut that off, man. Otherwise, your wife, she's gonna be hurting. You don't want a wife that's hurting. So that lands differently when it comes from another man. There's a good chance that your husband does not have good friends. You get him to church right now, because if you don't need their input in his lives at this minute, you are going to need it next year or 2 years from now. There is a power of having other godly men speak into your husband's life that you simply will never be able to provide. Thanks for being with us for this last hard-hitting Q&A segment. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.